From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It is a thematically diffuse show on this Monday, starting with a revamped exhibit at the Harley-Davidson Museum, showcasing an iconic sound of Milwaukee summers.
Later, piano arts jurist and professional pianist Anne Shine says it's tough to be an aspiring classical musician these days.
I don't remember a more difficult time for young people looking to the future. It's very confusing. There are no quick answers. You don't just practice hard and play in Carnegie Hall.
But cellist Robert Cohen says it's fulfilling to be a teacher working with older adult students.
I have to say it came as an enormous surprise. And it's made me feel that, you know, I really want to encourage people much, much more, that it's really never too late to learn an instrument.
And forget bowling, how axe throwing might become Milwaukee's next favorite pastime. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Imagine going to the Baseball Hall of Fame and knowing nothing about baseball, or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame having only listened to opera your whole life. That kind of disconnect is a key challenge for the curators of the Harley-Davidson Museum when it comes to presenting motorcycle engines.
One of the centerpieces of the museum's permanent collection is its engine room. It's a display that shows off engines from the iconic motorcycle, both how they look and how they sound. But they have to do it in a way that reaches people, regardless of their tech savvy.
Like a vintage engine, the engine room just got a rebuild this spring, so it seemed like the right time to stop by the now 10-year-old museum, where we met a couple of the key people behind the engine room, starting with curatorial and exhibits lead Kristen Jones.
You know, the engine room is a really important part of our visit. It actually is in the beginning of the museum, so it really functions as an introduction to a lot of the things that people are going to see throughout the rest of the exhibits. We undertook some visitor research last year, and we were able to kind of do a deep dive into what our visitors thought of our exhibits and what they were learning in our exhibits. And one of the things that we found out was that they weren't exactly using the engine wall and the accompanying interactive in the way that we had hoped they would. So we wanted to address that, and we wanted to update some things, but also make this a little bit more user-friendly. We get all kinds of people who come here with all different levels of knowledge. We have people who come here who are completely green, don't really know anything about engines, know that, you know, with their cars, for instance, you turn the key and it goes. To people who have lots of expertise, people who are engineers, people who are long-term mechanics. So we wanted to do something that could really focus on all of those different levels of knowledge.
Well, and so from a curatorial standpoint, what was the challenge in being able to do that in this space?
One of the challenges that we faced was really trying to make sure that we were holding everyone's attention. We wanted to make sure we were giving some of the basics, but also not making people who had a certain level of expertise feel like, oh, well, this really isn't for me. I know all of this already. We want to make sure that we engage people. We want to give them something new, maybe something that they never expected or didn't know before.
All right, so what is that? What's the new and unexpected when it comes to showcasing engines?
Well, the engines are really the heart of a Harley-Davidson, and each one is purpose-built. It's purpose-designed. So some of the engines were really, you know, made for racing, for instance, or they were made to cool in the desert for use during World War II. But our big twin family, that's really the core of our engine and our engine history. And we wanted to be able to give people some information as to the very basics of how an engine works, but also give them some trivia and also give some other assets out here on the floor.
I'm kind of amazed as I look at this because you have them arranged on the wall in timeline fashion, and obviously the newer ones are more sophisticated, but the look really hasn't changed all that much in 100 plus years.
Correct, and that V-twin shape, that 45-degree V-twin engine is really the hallmark of our engine history. And that's what we wanted to portray by putting those engines in the center. So we relocated all of the big twins to the center of the wall so that they're prominent. We added some interpretation as well. But we do have some unusual-looking engines that really deviate from that as well.
Before we get into the actual mechanics of a Harley engine, what else is in this room?
So this room is our engine gallery. We have many things dedicated to the look of the engine, the sound of the engine, and also the feel of the engine. And those are kind of the hallmark traits of Harley-Davidson, look, sound, and feel. So in the center of the gallery, we have a bike that is a knucklehead, which actually is one of the nicknames of one of our famous V-twins, where the pieces have been sliced apart, but from a certain vantage point, it resolves into a full motorcycle.
And as someone who does this kind of thing for a living, that is kind of, I mean, the viewscape that you have in this room. I mean, it is a big room, and you have kind of this unique ability to arrange it in such a way that it can be broken down into its component parts, but you can stand in such a way that it resolves into a single bike.
Yes, it's the exploded vehicle. It does resolve from a certain vantage point. And again, because this is one of the first galleries that people encounter during their visit, we wanted to give kind of a nice little extra surprise for people.
All right, so I appreciate the look of the engine. I appreciate the sound of the engine. Never having ridden a Harley myself, tell me how you simulate the feel of an engine.
We have an interactive here in the engine gallery where we actually have people be able to get a little bit more of a sense of the feel of a motorcycle. Now, of course, we're on radio, so you don't see me, but I'm a smaller individual. But I am able to balance a motorcycle because of the gyroscopic effect that's created by the very heavy flywheels that are in the engine. So the bike, when it's running at that speed, really wants to stay upright. So that allows people of all different sizes to be able to get on a big bike and ride it.
All right, well, I feel like at this point we really need to get more into the inner workings of the Harley engine. And before we do that, why don't I have you introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do here?
My name's Bill Redensel, and I am the lead for museum collections here.
All right, so take me through what visitors learn when they walk into this engine room. I'm sure they are drawn to this wall because A, it is illuminated, and B, it looks amazing.
Exactly, and that's part of the visual is to draw them in, to attract them here. And once we have them, what a lot of people, you know, they know an engine, they know it powers whatever vehicle it is, they just don't know actually how it works. So we tried to really simplify in the most basic terms, you know, how does an engine actually work? And people talk about, you know, our look, sound, feel. The way our engine and the geometry of our engine affects all of that. So we really explain through there. So we can actually, when guests come here, there are four kiosks that are all identical, have the same information, but they can step up to there, and there's three actual steps to the interactive. Engine basics, classic Harley engine, where you actually learn about our big twin, which is our classic Harley engine, and then get to explore all the engines that are exist on the engine wall. You get to actually look at both sides of them, see vehicles that they would be in, and then actually get to hear each and every engine that's on the wall.
And we should note that the engines on the wall are not the one, that they don't actually start up.
They don't actually start up. What we did is we had about, in our previous iteration of the wall, we had about half of the sounds. So we went about kind of traveling the United States to find, because some of these engines, they may be, they're one or two existing examples that actually run. And so we kind of did some field recordings to capture those unique sounds. And people get to hear a 1909 Harley single, or get to hear a opposed twin engine, which is a very different sounding engine than our typical twin.
So before we get to those sounds, because I think we really ought to hear some of those sounds, walk us through what we would learn here. What are the basics of a motorcycle engine?
So part of this wall, there's a little tactile display on the far right side and on the far left side, where, you know, people know a cylinder. Okay, well, what makes up a cylinder? What are the parts of that? So we actually have some pieces that they can touch and see to kind of get their feet wet a little bit before they get into the kiosk. Once they get into the kiosk, we start real simple. What's a one cylinder and what's a two cylinder, or our twin engine? When they started out, they called them singles and double cylinders, and now it's evolved into the twin. So you actually get to kind of look inside. So there's some animation. You get to see, how does that piston go up? What is a piston first? And how does it go up and down in the cylinder? How is it connected to the flywheel? And be able to compare and contrast between twins and single engines. And then you can actually touch the twins and it'll highlight in a graphic which engines on the wall you're looking at are the twins or are the singles. We talk about the actual engine geometry, 45 degrees where the cylinders are separated, 45 degrees, 60 degrees, or 180 degrees. This is a real big key in the sound of our engine. Engines have a cadence, and a single, having only one cylinder, is kind of a steady beat. In a 180 degree opposed twin, they fire actually opposite of each other, so it's boom, 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 boom. In our 45 degree twin, it's actually a cadence where they fire quickly after one another, so it's ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Also in here, you get to look at how it works. When we do how it works, we put a simple drum beat to it. This is our 180 degree, and you can see it's pretty constant. When you go to our 45 degree twin, little different pattern to that. And then of course single, when you go to the single, it's steady drum beat.
Steady, and in this case, very slow drum beat.
Yeah, and you notice it's only hitting half the time as a twin cylinder. There's, you know, when we talk about the four actual patterns of an engine, the flywheel, the big flywheel in the engine, will actually rotate two complete times in order to complete those four cycles of a four-cycle engine.
And so, you went out on these field recordings?
I did, actually. Believe it or not, in a past life, my degree from college was in sound engineering, and so I used to do a lot of that. And so I worked with a local engineer, and we traveled as far away as North Carolina to actually capture some of these engines. Some of them we found right around here in Milwaukee. One of them, the rarest, being our 8-valve, which is our it's a race engine. They only made about 25 total, so finding one and then finding one that runs is really extremely rare.
That must have been a kick.
It was great, and we actually made a couple little films of it, and you know, people will be able to actually, you know, go on our social media and see one of these run. They're really unique because there's no exhaust pipes on them, so the ports into the cylinder are open, and flames actually shoot out when it runs. So it's pretty neat.
We should hear this.
We should hear that one. Other race engines are XR750 that we had for years and years. And both of these are twin cylinders, but what's unique about them is, even though they're all 45 degrees, there is some bit of similarity between all of those.
Is there one that we would maybe never recognize as a Harley-Davidson if it weren't for the fact that you were telling us?
Absolutely. So if you go to our singles, there's several in here, but one of them is, believe it or not, we made from 1961 until 1978, we were partnered with a company in Italy, and they made some Italian-made singles, so we'll take a listen to one of these. Harley-Davidson also made a single-cylinder engine that was a two-stroke engine. So when you think of two-stroke, think of your lawnmower or something similar to that. And it was 165cc engine, and we made that from the 40s into the mid-60s. And you can take a listen to one of those.
Maybe the slightest bit louder than a lawnmower.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But very different. Not what people think of as that quintessential Harley-Davidson potato, potato, potato.
Let me ask this question to both of you, actually.
Sure.
So this came together over how long did it take to bring this revamped engine room together?
We were working on it for about 7 months.
So there has to be, if not a sense of ownership, certainly a real connection to what you've been able to do. As you look around, I mean, how do you, you know, sort of reconcile what was in your mind with what you see around us today?
I think what we've done really, you know, sometimes we were both involved in the original iteration, and sometimes it's hard to let go of that. But I think what we've done here really improves the experience for our visitors. You know, we are coming up on our 10th year of being open. And we're really evaluating how people have been using things here over the past 10 years and always looking to improve and always looking to give our visitors the best experience possible.
Well, right. I imagine that, you know, at one level, you have to realize that that what you do doesn't exist in a vacuum. Like, what you think visitors might get out of an exhibit and what they actually do get out of an exhibit can often be two different things.
Yes, I think that that's true. I think, you know, sometimes what people, what we envision people getting out of an exhibit is actually different from what we observe. And one of the things that's difficult, we have such an amazing, vast collection of materials here. And of course, it's hard for us to sometimes decide what to edit. And that was one of the challenges with this engine wall, is that we actually took some engines away because they didn't really help to tell the story that we were looking to tell.
I have to say, the thing that was really came through to me is we're such a small group that did this. And the first time we did it, it was, we didn't know. We had never, you know, even built a museum of this magnitude. So we were like, well, this would be neat. And even that changed as we did it. And you came out with the final product and it was great. Then you find out, we could have done it better. And so we're really lucky to get that second shot to say, let's do it. Let's do some of the things we wanted to do in the first time. Like Kristen said, take away some of the things that, you know, we put up there just because they were neat. But did they confuse people? Did it not really, you know, tell that story that you wanted to communicate? Plus, in 10 years, the company has changed a lot, and we've come out with a lot of different new products, and we want to represent those on the wall as well.
Has to be a little like being a musician who, you know, puts out an album and figures, well, this one's going to be the hit, and it turns out everybody likes this one.
A little bit of that, or the musician that says, oh, if I could go in and re-record that. And so we were given the ability to actually, like, you know, do a do-over and say, let's do it. And so we didn't really radically change it, because it's quite behind the actual wall, the structure that holds it up. There's no moving it. It's pretty permanent, but we were able to, shift it around and really, I think, just tell the story clearer.
Got to be a pretty strong wall. Those must be pretty heavy engines.
There's quite a superstructure actually behind the drywall there. But we've actually modified the way that we're attaching the engines so that in the future, as we want to make additional changes, we can do so more easily.
Well, thanks to both of you, and congratulations on the redesign.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Kristen Jones is the curatorial and exhibits lead, and Bill Rodenzel is the collections lead at the Harley-Davidson Museum. You can see a slideshow from the museum's redesigned engine room at WUWM.com.
A group of supremely talented young pianists is in Milwaukee right now competing in the Biennial International Piano Arts Competition. We'll talk with one of the jurists who decides who will take home the grand prize when we return with Lake Effect on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Every 2 years, Milwaukee hosts an internationally renowned competition for young, early career pianists called Piano Arts. Since last Wednesday, the students have been performing in a series of recitals, and tomorrow evening, the finalists will take the stage to compete for the top prizes.
But the week is not just for the competitors. There is a series of public events as well, including tonight's performance at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center in Brookfield by two of the three jurists who are deciding this year's winners. Anne Schein is one of those judges. She's had a long and distinguished career and is a specialist in the music of Frédéric Chopin, and she joins me in the studio to talk about her work and what she looks for in young competitors. Welcome to the show.
It's wonderful to be here. I'm thrilled. This is a very well-known city, well-known arts center, and to be involved in helping young people and seeing what you're doing here is really inspiring.
Well, we're inspired by having you here, too, and I know we're going to get a concert from you Monday evening, but before we talk about what you're going to play, I do want to talk about the other reason you're here, which is what you mentioned, mm-hmm. the fact that Piano Arts every 2 years has this wonderful competition for young pianists,
yes.
pianists at the very yes. beginning of their career.
Yes.
How difficult is it now for people at that age compared to when you were starting mm. out? Are there fewer venues for them to actually perform?
Well, I say very often with our culture today and our world today, I don't remember a more difficult time for young people looking to the future. It's very confusing. There are no quick answers. You don't just practice hard and play in Carnegie Hall. It is a whole media change, technology change, concentration change. Families are not so into home music as they once were, maybe if I can say 50 years ago. I remember when I began to teach at Peabody Conservatory, I was already 40 years old. I had not had a job teaching before, but it only took one exciting student, my first one, to get me completely hooked. And I would say out of the 21 years that I taught there, I could split it in two halves. The first half, fabulous talents, hard workers, serious kids, knew where they wanted to go much more than now. And then the technology came in. Now, that's not always a bad thing, but it was very evident that the practice time and the patience and the long-range thinking and dreams were kind of shattered in a way. And today, I think it's even more confusing. There's such a global reach for classical music, but is there? It's a question. So it's the individual talent, the individual, I always emphasize the strength of their character in this world, and the bewildering amount of news that comes at us all the time. I think it's the most difficult period for young aspiring students that I remember in my experience.
The other thing I think that's happened along with all of that is there are fewer and fewer places that are programming classical music.
Yes.
So
yes.
there are fewer places for people to find jobs to
yes.
actually perform.
Yes. And I think the self-promotion is a big thing. If people have imagination, they can maybe make a blog, like Jeremy Denk has a great blog. And this is a creative area that not every music student is going to have. But when they do have it, it could add dimensions to their own personality and individuality, which is what we're looking for. Individuality. Imagination.
I was going to say, too, the other thing that has changed is that the record companies have completely changed.
Yes.
The idea of having an A&R person coming yes. out to and then nurturing
yes.
you along
yes.
and helping you do the publicity, that doesn't really seem to exist anymore, except maybe people who are at the very top of the
yes.
heap.
I had, in my experience, a most miraculous happening when an A&R engineer who had studied with my Peabody teacher, Mieczysław Munz, great Polish pianist and teacher at Peabody, he came to find Munz to get him to record for then the Cap Record Company, who had made a great deal of money with their more popular area, with Roger Williams, with Jane Morgan. And now they wanted four classical pianists. So this young A&R man, wonderful, gifted man, came to my teacher to try to get him to make one of these records. I had just performed a concerto, and he had the tape. He said, no, I'm not performing, but would you listen to this then 16-year-old? And the engineer was very enthusiastic and said, I would like Hurst, one of the four, now. And my wise teacher said, no, you can't have her. I will think of it in 2 years if you want to come back. And he did come back. So that was my beginning, was the recording at its zenith. the LPs and the record stores, and people listened to the radio and recordings and collected. We have a collection that I'm not sure my children will be able to handle when we're not there. It's so huge, but it is rich. And, of course, it's not there now. CDs are there, and self-made CDs are going strong if promoted well. It can be very helpful, but it is completely changed. However, what for me is very comforting, we're helping young people with music that does not change. It's universal, it's art, and it's not subject to fads, fashion, media. Nothing's going to change a Beethoven Opus 111. There it is. We were talking at lunch about the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven. It has surely the same effect as it always has. And this is what we're trying, us old folks, teaching to emphasize to the young people, that they are touching works of art that are real truth. And they don't change. The world may change, but they're on a long road with this music. It's not going to come overnight. It's the patience today that is at a premium also.
I love the visual image of being on the journey with the music. Mm. And that is true. It is a lifetime journey, right, of interacting with the music,
yes,
that you have the passion for. And as you say, that passion exists whether you're 13 or 83. It doesn't really matter. It's just whether you have the opportunity at 13 to continue with that journey.
And I think those of us who have reached this terribly old age can be good examples that they can have a long life, and that it doesn't stop or achieve something or make it by 20 or in the early years. It's only part of the way. And my incredible fortune was going to a teacher. I had wonderful teachers my parents chose for me. But the one at 13 at Peabody, the great Polish pianist, said to my parents, "I think I see a long life in music, and are you willing to do what I think is necessary to put the right foundation down?" And that was 5 years plus. "Of course," they said, "no question." And I thought it was normal because my family made me feel normal about it, but it certainly wasn't normal. And I don't know too many individual teachers that will devote 5+ years to a student in that way. And it's the only reason I play today, is the foundation that he put down, that he had a vision. I don't know what gave him the vision, because I don't think I played all that well at 13. I just did my thing. But my parents always felt that whatever the age, you are what you are at that age, and it's a beautiful thing. It isn't the end result at all. It's where you are at that moment. And frankly, I'm playing a lot of the same music that I played when I was a teenager and was taught beautifully. I didn't know what they meant, the works. I had no idea of the depth. But as I go on, and I can still play at some point, I don't know if it's the same or not, but all I know is that this great music keeps giving. And every phase of performing these so-called same works unfolds more. And that is a thrill that I try very hard to convey to students. And I do have a passion, like a missionary, for young people today.
Which is why you're here, to be on the jury for Piano Arts. And you mentioned earlier that you're looking, in addition to the passion and that some that connection to the music, you're also looking for individuality.
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that in terms of the music and how they approach it?
Well, I would say we're looking for fine guidance. We can tell technically if there's been enough patience to have a clear picture. For instance, it's always fascinated me that the famous lessons that Liszt gave to finished artists, he said, "I don't want any dirty laundry here." And he picked all artistic, finished, virtuoso, great musician people in Weimar. No dirty laundry. But that takes a lot of time. And it develops at different paces with different students. So the teachers have to have patience, too, for the individual. But in a competition, what I find difficult is that we are forced to compare. And we don't hear one person at their maximum. We hear a great many. And I have a particular, this was my teaching experience with juries and auditions, which is like a competition, of course, of writing like shorthand, everything I can write down as they're playing so that I can refer to it. And those details can make a very great difference in the end result. I enjoy it for that reason, because some things are better than others, some pieces, but something stands out if the imagination and that excitement comes through. Perhaps it's an interpretation you've never thought of or heard before, and that's where the teachers, those of us who are privileged to teach, learn a lot. Perhaps we didn't play it that way, but they have given an insight in their talent that is just fantastic for the teachers. It's a, you know, things that people say all the time that you learn the most as teachers, but I do believe it, because every student that comes in has their own voice, and we're looking for that individual voice, at least I am, and I'm sure my colleagues are.
Anne Shine is a member of the 2018 Piano Arts Jury. She's also teaching masterclasses and performs a concert this evening at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield. There's more information about her and about piano arts at WUWM.com. The music we're hearing, by the way, was performed by Anne Shine. It's Chopin's Sonata No. 3 in B minor, which she will perform tonight.
Cellist and Lake Effect contributor Robert Cohen works with young people as well. But as we learn on our next On That Note segment, he gets a distinct pleasure in working with students at the other end of the age spectrum. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we heard about a Milwaukee-based competition that attracts aspiring young concert pianists from around the world. Cellist Robert Cohen is no stranger to working with young musicians. A great part of his career is about not just performing, but teaching.
But it's not just young people that he teaches, as we'll find out. We caught up with Robert via Skype from his home in London. Robert, it is great to hear your voice. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Bonnie. Great to hear you, too. It seems so long between you.
I know. It's once a month, but it feels like much, much longer. And I understand you just came back from one of my favorite parts of France.
That's right, from this area called the Charente, which is just rolling, beautiful, beautiful countryside.
And some delicious melons and cognac.
Well, of course, yes.
Of
and
course.
The food wasn't bad either. Really.
No, they do it quite well there. And so you were on various chamber music tours, is that what was happening?
Yes, some concerts there, which was, you know, delightful, and there's beautiful churches and just a kind of more relaxed, you know, so used to playing in cities and with all the hustle and bustle and the noise, and it was just so lovely to be away from all of that. And to meet people and just to have an audience who come and chat to you, and you know, you have time, and that was really such a pleasure.
Yeah, it's funny, we tend to think of music making now as it's a business, you know, and you come in and you do and you have to fill the hall and you have to do this, but this sounds like it's in some ways more old-fashioned.
Yeah, and you know what, I had yet another experience which I've had actually in recent times, which is that somebody asked me if I would help them on the cello, you know, learning the cello. And this is a lady, a French lady in her 60s, and she just decided that she wanted to learn the cello. And I was there, and she thought, well, maybe she can get some advice. So I went to her lovely house in the rolling countryside and sat down with her, and really starting almost from the very, very beginning to help her to learn something about playing the cello. And that experience has happened to me, as I said, you know, a few times lately, that older people have had a kind of passion to learn to play the cello and just decided maybe they've got a bit more time, or, you know, they've just been brave. And we so often think, you know, the discussion is always about, should your child start at age 5 to learn the cello or violin, or was it better to wait until they're 8 or they're 12? The discussion is always about that, but never about what happens, you know, later. And people are very often quite afraid and feel that it's far too late to learn something. And I have to say that my experience with these people has been really fantastic and really inspiring, because even when I'm helping them, they follow directions so carefully. You know, they relate the instructions about their physical and technical and their posture, for instance, to their kind of things that have happened in their life. They understand what you're talking about because they've been involved in sports, or because they just have become sort of bodily aware as they get older. And so they listen with this kind of intensity and understanding of what you're saying, and they're very, very careful. They understand a kind of a learning process, which, you know, children don't really understand that. They just, you know, they're given things to do.
There's something about when you're older, you understand. You might get impatient, but you understand that things take time.
Yeah, I think that their patience actually is, I mean, it may be frustrating, but they are very, very patient. And they use their sort of life experiences to help them understand, you know, the difficulties that they'll, you know, inevitably encounter. And they've been through things to know how to get around those difficulties. And they have a realistic sense of, you know, what they want to achieve. Most children are not seeing that far ahead. And I think that older people really do. And the other thing I found really interesting is that they kind of attach a sort of the kind of spiritual side of, you know, the importance of music in their life, and they attach that to the learning of music and being involved in music. And since, you know, you and I are always talking about this, the fact that music is its own language, it's in its own space, and it has, you know, life enhancing qualities, which we all know about. But I think this spiritual side I found with these people, even you can feel it when they're just sitting, finding a really good position, drawing the bow across the string very gently in the very early stages. You can feel them kind of attaching it to this sense of what is it all about. And that's really beautiful. And I must say that it's really inspiring to see people do that.
Do you think that there's a difference both for them and for you in that none of these people are likely pursuing a professional career? They're doing this just for themselves.
You're so right. And they really are doing it for themselves, because I overheard one of them practicing the day after I'd given them a lesson, and I could kind of feel their carefulness and their sense of what they were doing. And yes, they quite clearly, they're not going to expect to start their solo career at age 85. You hear them enjoying the beauty of learning and being involved in music, maybe for the very first time. And so, yes, I think it is a sense of they don't have to take this on. But I think children also don't, you know, they're very often just do it because they've been told to, or because it seems to be fun. I mean, even for myself, you know, very early on, I mean, although I was involved in music so much, and my parents, you know, as you know, were musicians, and I went to a specialist music school, and I did want to play enormously. But even when I was 10, 11, 12, and already starting to do some concerts and things, I'm not sure that I really knew inside myself that this was 100%, what, you know, this is my life. I just knew I loved doing it, but I'm not sure I knew what it was to have a life in music. That was quite a sort of abstract thing as a young person.
As a teacher, do you approach someone differently, knowing that they're not going to become a professional, knowing that they're 60 or 70 or 80 and they're just doing this for themselves?
Well, I'm responding to the way that they're listening and the way they're moving. And of course, physically, they're fully developed. They're not like children, but they also see certain frailty. And in a way, that helps because you don't push them too much. You have to know that they have to go gently. And of course, they're responding to everything you say in this way that, you know, they know that they're only with you for a very short time in that lesson. And you have the sense that, you know, they're going to go away and research and they're going to check things out, maybe, you know, on the internet, and they're going to do everything they can. And you know that they're also going to be disciplined and they're probably going to do what I say, which is, you know, a little bit of practice every day until you build some strength and your body gets used to these strange movements. And you can sense that they really are taking that on. And so you move through the lesson in a certain way, in a very, you know, this is my experience anyway, that you feel very connected and it's a very intense time. And at the end of the time with that lesson, you have that sense that they're going to hold on to that and they're going to use every single word you've said, and they're going to want to come back later and ask you, you know, a lot of questions, detailed questions, you know, knowing what's happened and how they've learned. And that's actually happened to me, that, you know, hoping to see them again at some point, but they've written to me and they've written fantastic questions, really very relevant and very intelligent and aware about what they've learned so far. And so it's very fulfilling as a teacher to work with people like that. And I have to say, it came as an enormous surprise. And it's made me feel that, you know, I really want to encourage people much, much more. That it's really never too late to learn an instrument. And if you have that kind of desire to make sound and make music and be involved in it, you really shouldn't be afraid. You can do it. You really can. And it's not just that, oh, I must be past it by now.
Right. Or, you know, I'll never be at your level, so I might as well not even start.
Yeah, that's very, very important. And who knows what level we'll reach. This French lady said to me, what I really want to be able to do is to play a movement of Bach. And I thought, you know, she will definitely do it. I mean, it's not out of possibilities for her. I mean, it'll take some time to build all sorts of controls and so on, and she's learning the music. But even if she plays slowly a beautiful movement of Bach, she's going to get immense pleasure from that, you know, achieving something that she desires. Also, as a mature adult, I think you can recognize your own improvements and your own achievements really well. We have that sort of we have, you know, the experience to know that we've got from A to B, and we can look at it really clearly. That's an enormous advantage when you're learning, always to be able to see what you've achieved, isn't it? I mean, that gives you the strength to move on.
Well, speaking of Bach, I think it was the last time we were speaking, you were about to engage in a marathon evening.
That's right.
How did that go?
I do it very rarely, but it's really an extraordinary experience to play all six Bach solo suites. And it was by candlelight. There was almost no light at all, just a flickering couple of candles, and sitting for 3.5 hours playing Bach. And the experience is just, you enter the world of Bach, which is one of the, you know, he has one of the greatest genius composers of all time. Just to enter into his world is enormous privilege and extraordinarily special and immensely satisfying and exhausting and requiring so much concentration. But the audience is with you every note throughout that enormous amount of time. And of course, you know, to be honest, a lot of those audience members are older rather than younger. I mean, fortunately, there were also young people at the concert. But I think we all feel this kind of sense of time in Bach, which, you know, it's like being in a different time zone. And certainly for me, playing it was really extraordinary. And every year or two or maybe three, I do it again because it's such a marathon. It's enormous commitment to prepare for it. But I did really, really enjoy it enormously, I must say.
Well, I hope that the next time you do it, I am close enough to be able to come hear it. I'm happy to sit there for the 3.5 hours and let Bach wash over me. It sounds like just a divine thing. But Robert, as always, it is such a pleasure to hear your voice and to hear what you've been up to. I look forward to next month.
Absolutely, Bonnie.
Contributor Robert Cohen is an internationally recognized cellist who also teaches. He also joins us each month to talk about the life of a working classical musician in a series we call On That Note.
Musicians often refer to their instruments as their axes. But do axe throwers refer to their axes as instruments? Well, we'll find out when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. It seems new concepts are always popping up to compete with traditional bars and restaurants. Take cat cafes, where felines roam among customers, or painting studios, where you sip a glass of wine while nursing your creative side.
But if your tastes are a little less sedate, you could try hurling a hatchet at a wall. The activity known as axe throwing is kind of like darts on steroids. And as WUWM's Annalise Henzel reports, the pastime is spreading rapidly right here in Wisconsin.
The thought of hurling sharp, potentially dangerous objects doesn't appeal to everyone. But Jason Hillesheim was enamored with the idea as soon as he learned about it.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't want to throw an axe? At least try to.
So Hillesheim was one of the first customers a couple weeks ago when Milwaukee's first axe-throwing establishment, called Fling, opened its doors. He lined up inside what looks kind of like a batting cage, waiting his turn to hurl a hatchet at a target painted on the wooden wall.
The first one, I think I tried to throw it a little too much. And the second one, it was a little less. And then that third one, I kind of just let it fly on its own. And it stuck. It felt really good.
Hillesheim says there's something satisfying about the thunk of a hatchet digging into the wood. In fact, that's what grabbed Fling owner Becky Cooper Clancy, who first threw an axe on a whim at a bar in Canada a few years ago.
And it was so fun. And the first time I landed an axe in the target, it was just such a visceral feeling of accomplishment that I was hooked from the very first time.
Cooper Clancy already owned Bounce, a family entertainment center in Milwaukee with an arcade, laser tag, restaurant, and bar. They expanded it to include axe throwing. She admits that children can freely roam from one area to another, but Cooper Clancy says they're not in danger. Only paying customers, older kids, and adults can access the fenced-in throwing lanes.
We designed our arena to be fully enclosed with a fence so that nobody is inside the throwing arena who shouldn't be. We're completely enclosed. We've got locks on the gates. We have locks on the cabinets that store the axes themselves.
Fling got its safety guidelines from the National Axe Throwing Federation, or NATF. So have other facilities, including an axe throwing bar that's opening on Milwaukee's east side this month. Matt Wilson is commissioner for the Toronto-based NATF.
The NATF is a governing body for rules and trying to grow the sport as a like promotional entity. And so we're trying to bring the best of the best to be a part of that and really set the standard high and say, hey, this is how it's done, and you know, you should do the same.
Wilson helped establish the indoor version of axe throwing more than a decade ago, and he's founder and CEO of a chain of axe throwing bars called Battle. There are 14 locations in the U.S. and Canada, and Battle plans to open more in the U.S. soon.
It just continues to grow in popularity, and more organizations are popping up all the time, not just in North America, but worldwide. I think it's definitely not at its peak at all.
Wilson says there are a couple of reasons the activity is so attractive. There's something primal about hurling a hatchet. And he says there's an art to throwing axes and joy in mastering technique. Jonathan Winsky certainly agrees with the appeal of the sport. He's co-founder of Midwest Knife and Axe Throwers. Winsky has been tossing hatchets for decades and teaching people how, including in his yard in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin.
Basically, it's just a single rotation. It's a first one.
Winsky is pleased the sport is catching on, but as its popularity grows, he's worried that axe throwing facilities will crop up that don't follow best practices.
My concern is there someone teaching? Do they have a good knowledge base, some good history behind them? What is their experience? And is there some form of line or range monitor or supervisor that's keeping an eye on everything?
Winsky says his concern level rises when bars and restaurants, places that serve drinks, are offering axe throwing.
It's not an old fuddy-duddy, oh, alcohol is, you know, just going to screw everything up. That's not it. But alcohol definitely does play a part.
Members of Winsky's group, Midwest Knife and Axe Throwers, travel throughout the summer giving lessons at places like Renaissance fairs and pirate fests. He says it's not uncommon for people to walk up, beer in hand, and ask to throw an axe. Nor is it uncommon for instructors to turn them away after picking up on subtle signs of inebriation. I'm Annalise Henzel, 89.7 WUWM.
Fling, Milwaukee's first axe-throwing facility, will be joined by another soon. Axe Milwaukee is scheduled to open on the city's east side on Saturday, June 16th. From Harleys to classical music to axe throwing, that wraps up a unique edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
As long as you're not riding your Harley while playing classical music and throwing an axe, I think you're okay.
Two of the three of those would be okay, though.
Would be. It would be. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.